And in this instruction, we're going to get started on that pathway that she showed us. And we're going to specifically pick up one principle for exposition, structure. So I'm going to put a drawing up, and you all are going to tell me what it is, okay? Here we go. All right. What's that? Someone sees a cross. Yeah, you're meant to be confused. It's okay. All right. If you squint really hard at that screen, this picture is what a construction crew in England came across in 2015. They were renovating a beautiful house, and as they were digging in the dirt, they came across bones. Those are meant to be bones. Yeah. Okay, you guys are all like, all right, bones, yes, I'm not a great artist either. But there's bones in the ground. Yikes. Well, that could mean a couple of different things, couldn't it? So renovations were halted and experts were brought in. And these experts were archaeologists. And they carefully removed the dirt and the debris. And they were able to determine that the bones were human. And they were actually meant to look something like this. Here we go. Is that more recognizable? All right. And these archaeologists were also able to determine that the bones were very old. And finally, they saw that on the ankle bones of the skeleton, there were a pair of shackles. So we've got these old 2,000-year-old bones on a skeleton with shackles all together. This is in England. The archaeologists were able to put together a story of slavery in England under the Roman Empire. So this archaeological process is somewhat similar to the way we approach a biblical text. All texts have bones. They have sections that give the text structure. And our job as Bible teachers is to uncover those sections and to figure out what are the bones, what are the sections in this text. And then we don't want to stop at that, because that's not very helpful. We want to understand how the parts relate to one another so that we can see the emphasis of the author coming out of the text. So, here's our principle. Every text has a structure. The structure will reveal an emphasis, and the emphasis must shape our message. Every text has a structure. The structure will reveal an emphasis, and the emphasis must shape our message. And to find the structure of a text, we're going to ask the question, how has the author organized this passage? Now, I know you guys have all been working on this. When you were preparing your worksheets, that first question that you came to on structure, that was really easy, right? You just flew right through that one? No, yeah, I'm seeing a lot of heads shaking. It can be really hard work to uncover the structure of a text. So let me ask you a question, and I'll give you a minute to think about it. What has been hard for you in finding structure, specifically in Old Testament history texts? What's hard about finding the structure in Old Testament history? While you think about it, let me give you two of mine. I find it hard in Old Testament history because I'm fascinated by the people. I want to dig into the characters, and I want to think about their motivations, and I want to analyze their decisions. But often, that kind of character analysis is not really the emphasis of the text. So getting too focused on that can be like only seeing one arm of the skeleton. We want to understand characters and the details about them as it relates to the whole skeleton so that we're seeing the whole shape and emphasis of the text. So that's one thing that I find hard. Here's one more. Have you ever taught a text from Old Testament history by retelling the story and kind of going line by line through the text and just talking about everything? Yeah, I've done that too. And I think that that's trying to be faithful to the text. I'm not going to beat myself up too much for that. But it's kind of like treating the little pinky bone the same as the skull. Not everything is equally important in a text, and we don't have to talk about everything. So again, we want to understand how the pinky bone relates to the rest of the structure so that we can understand what the author of the text is emphasizing and bring that out. So those are kind of my two things that I find hard, and I'd be curious to hear from a few of you. What did you find hard in looking for structure in Old Testament history texts? Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's absolutely true. Old Testament literature generally, and Old Testament history in particular, kind of defies our modern outlines a little bit. What else? Anything else? And yeah.
I don't know if this is true for everybody else, but typical church culture did not prepare me from, like, Old Testament history was always taught as Sunday school stories, so it was always about the character. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. It's absolutely true. Some of us were set up to just focus on the arm, right? Yeah, that's great. Well, I think what we're seeing here is that those are limitations, and we're not ready to move on to writing our study or our talk until we've understood the structure and emphasis of a text. So, this is a workshop on Old Testament history, specifically 1 Samuel 1 and 2. And there are three different text types in the Bible. So the first one, they don't go in any particular order, but one is poetry. You'll find that in like the Psalms predominantly. Another is discourse, which you'll find predominantly in the epistles. Discourses are speeches that are developed with rhetoric to make an argument. And third, you find narrative. You find stories. So let me ask you a question. In 1 and 2 Samuel, which of these text types do we find most often? Narrative. Yeah. Mostly in 1 and 2 Samuel, we have narrative. There is a little bit of poetry. Where do we see poetry? Hannah's song, and then at the very end of 2 Samuel, we have David, a song from David as well. So there is a little bit of poetry. And discourse, those are speeches, right? So think Samuel's farewell speech. That has a narrative frame, so it's kind of like narrative functioning as discourse. So there's a little bit of these two things, but by and large, we have lots and lots of narrative. So over the next couple of days, we're going to focus on strategies that will help us in narrative texts because that's predominantly what we're in. All right, so let's talk strategies. What things might we do and what might we look for to find the structure of a narrative passage? Yeah. Conflict and climax, good. Yeah, I'm going to call that plot arc. And conflict and climax are two pieces of it. And that's a really important one. We're going to come back to it with an exercise. But for now, it looks like that. Looks like a witch hat. What else? Uh-huh. Yep, sometimes looking at the beginning and the end can be helpful, either to look for repetition at the beginning and the end or change between the beginning and the end, looking for a trajectory. What else? Yeah. Characters. And how do characters help us when we look for structure? Yeah, we might have a contrast between two characters, or we might, if we could like picture the text as a video, we might see a change between a focus on one character to, oh, now we've changed scenes and we're focusing on a new character. So that could help us see structure.
Or how that character is changing over the passage.
Yep, we might see
growing or not growing.
Yep, we might see change in the character, and that might be just a distraction like the arm, or it might be the emphasis of the text. That's what this wrestling with structure is going to help us determine. What other strategies?
You mentioned that the scenes.
Yep. I'm going to actually make scenes an umbrella here. And let's add, so characters, think about like when a movie changes scenes. We might shift from one character to another, but what else also changes?
Setting.
Yeah. So characters can help us see a change in scenes. Setting can help us see a change in scenes. What about if it goes from dark to light? Time, a change in time. Good. And we are missing our multi-tool, repetition. Repetition is like probably the only tool that you will use in every genre. It's always helpful. So that's like your multi-tool. You take it everywhere. Good. Anything else we're missing? Yes, absolutely. Prayer and, no one likes to say the obvious ones, read the text. But seriously, I can't overemphasize the importance of reading the text. We want to read it. We want to read it in multiple translations. We want to just saturate ourselves in it, because otherwise we'll just sit there and stare at it and be like, I don't see bones. It requires reading and rereading to start to like know how to pull away the dirt and see the sections.
Sometimes listening to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hearing someone else read it.
Yep. Hearing someone else read it can just, they might just read it in a different way and you're like, oh, like light bulbs. Yeah, good. All right, so these are some good strategies. Do we have any questions on the strategies at this point? We're going to get into a couple of exercises where we use them. But questions right now? All right, good. Let's get into an exercise then. So, imagine that a friend of yours who leads a women's ministry at another church is going through a series on 1 Samuel, and she invites you to come teach on 1 Samuel 5, which is the text about the Ark of the Lord in the land of the Philistines and Dagon's temple. It's like super weird because, you know, it's always a good idea to give the weird text to a guest presenter. So she invites you to come do that, and you open up to 1 Samuel 5, and you look through it really quick, and you're like, oh, I see a statue of Dagon. That sounds like a god, and it's not the god. And, oh, and look, the statue of Dagon is going to get broken. Ooh, maybe this text is about idolatry. I think my argument, my main point for my audience is going to be smash the idols in your life. That sounds really good. But you know what? That's jumping pretty quickly straight to us now without going around our pathway. So let's put a pin in that and instead start around our pathway for preparation and see if we can uncover the structure of this text using our strategy of characters. So you guys are probably there. 1 Samuel 5. You are going to go into your little groups at your tables like in the last session. And first, you're going to read the text aloud, read it quickly. And then you're going to identify two scenes based on characters. So we're going to use the strategy of characters and identify two scenes. And I'll give you a hint. Both scenes, God's going to show up in them. But if you kind of imagine the video camera, who's alongside the Lord, and when does that shift? Characters, two scenes. I'll give you like 2.5 minutes. Go. All right, so let's bring it back together. So what was the shift in characters that you guys observed? What was the shift in characters that you guys observed? Okay, so we saw the people. Where do you see the people? Okay, yep. So you guys are observing some movement between cities in that. Where is that happening? Okay. Okay, I'm hearing some different answers. Let's go at this from verses instead. Who broke the text into two sections? All right. Yeah.
5:1-5 and then 6-12.
Okay. So you have 1-5 and 6-12. How'd you get there?
1-5, the scene is God's hand is heavy on their idol, and 6-12, the hand of God is heavy on the people.
Okay. Okay, so we have people in the second section, and in the first you called it the idol, but who is it?
Dagon.
It's Dagon. So yeah, we kind of have Dagon versus God here, and then we have the people, or the Philistines, versus God in the second half. All right, and then it sounds like some of you were starting to get into a little bit more movement in that second half, where you're seeing it move from the Ashdodites to the Ekronites to the, yeah, you were seeing that too. And that's good. Yeah, you're getting even into more than just two scenes. But we do see that shift from like God and Dagon to God and the Philistines, right? All right, good. So these characters help us see this shift in scene. And I'm helping us do this quickly by identifying a strategy. But if you were coming at this text fresh, you'd want to try a bunch of strategies and see what works well for you and on this text. And sometimes you'll see multiple strategies are mutually reinforcing, and that can be a really helpful sign to be like, I'm on the right path here. So do that really quickly, actually. Go back to your group for just 30 seconds and add the layer of setting. What is our primary shift in setting between verses 1-5 and 6-12? All right, so where are we in verses 1-5? We're in the temple. And where are we in verses 6-12? Yeah, we're in the cities. So we went back with our strategy of setting and saw that it reinforced what we were seeing with the strategy of characters. That's great. We're not making this up. We're actually uncovering what's there. We're working like archaeologists. All right, so these are our bones. How often do we then stop? And we're like, all right, got my bones, turn it over. These are going to be my main points, and I'm writing my talk. Well, we're not quite there yet, because at this point, we still just have this. We've identified our parts, but we haven't yet thought about how they fit together or how they reveal an emphasis. So we need to keep going. All right, so we're going to send you back to your groups, and you're going to work on two things. I'm just going to put them in the middle so that you can still see these two parts. We're going to assume this is our structure. If not all of you are convinced, that's fine. Go with it for the purpose of the next 10 minutes, okay? You're going to do two things. We're going to add a strategy. We're going to add our multi-tool. We're going to add repetition. So look for repetition in both the first half and the second half. And then we're going to think about how our bones fit together. How do they connect? And for that one, think about what is the way, how is God interacting with Dagon and with the Philistines? Is there any similarity in the way he's interacting with each? So repetition and how these two sections connect. Take 2 minutes. Go. All right. So what did you guys find? What was repeated in verses 1-5? Yeah. Fallen. And where is he fallen? Yeah, before the ark. All right. Good. What was repeated in that second half? 6-12. Yeah, and what's the hand like? Heavy. He's got this strong, heavy hand. What else was repeated? There was more. There was a lot repeated in the second half.
They were moving the ark.
Yeah, there's this idea of movement. I like that. I'm just writing move.
They kept saying, the ark must not remain here.
Right, yeah, the people were terrified, weren't they? Yeah, there's fear, there's terror, there's, I can't stay here. Yep. Yeah. So we've got the ark in both. Good.
Tumors.
Tumors. Yeah, there are a lot of tumors. Good. And what does it say over and over again that God is doing to the Philistines? Yeah, afflicting. All right, he's afflicting them. I don't know if you can read all that, but the one thing we have left to do, we're starting to understand how... Oh, we haven't talked about connection. Sorry. Connection. How do the two sections fit together? Is there any similarity in the way God's relating to Dagon and God's relating to the Philistines? I see, yes. Someone want to take a stab at describing that for us? Yeah. Ooh, I like that. Yeah, that's really good. Oh, thank you. She said Dagon's hands are cut off, and then we see God's hands being strong and heavy. Yeah, that's really good. I honestly hadn't seen that before, and I'm going to preach this to y'all tomorrow. So there you go. You're pushing me forward. It's great. All right. So what is the similarity? We're seeing similarity between the way God's interacting with Dagon and God's interacting with the Philistines. That's probably enough for now that we know there's similarity and God's interacting with two different sets of characters in a similar way. Go back and talk for 1 minute about what emphasis does this structure, which we're all just going to go with for now, what emphasis does this give us? And an emphasis... we haven't defined that yet, have we? An emphasis could be a short sentence. It could be a couple of phrases. It could be a list of words. Like, whatever is helpful to you, like, get it out what you think this structure is showing us that the author is emphasizing. That's our goal. Okay? 1 minute. Go. All right. So what'd you guys come up with? I know I'm making you work really fast. We would normally take so much more time on these steps. Does someone want to share? What do you think the emphasis is coming from this structure? All right. Yeah. Love it. And there was one more up front here. Yeah. So we've got this omnipotent, strong God against Dagon, against the Philistines. This is really good. And this has kind of clarified our first impression, hasn't it? This, as a whole, this is not a text about just destroying idols. This is a text about God's strength against these enemies, against Dagon and against the Philistines. So that's really helped us to kind of clarify and not, we'll have to throw out, I guess, smash your idols. That can't be my talk title anymore. So that's a bummer, but we'll have to come up with something else. All right. So any questions at this point about, this was really focusing on scenes and characters and setting. Any questions about using those strategies? All right, we're going to get to the one that baffles us all then. Plot arc, yep. All right, so turn to 1 Kings 18. We're going to look at verses 20 to 40. And imagine that your church has been emphasizing evangelism and the youth director has asked you to come give a talk to the youth to really inspire the youth to be bold in evangelism. And so you're kind of scratching your chin going, okay, bold, bold, bold. Who's bold? Elijah. Elijah's really bold, especially in that contest he had with the prophets of Baal, man, dumping the water. Like, that was a bold move right there. Let's go give a talk to the youth. And we are going to inspire them to be bold like Elijah. But we might be falling into my own favorite trap right there, which is focusing too much on character, right? Maybe we're just seeing an arm. So let's apply our strategy of plot arc to this text and see if we can't get a better idea of what this text is talking about. But first, we have to actually talk about what a plot arc is, right? Because we haven't actually done that yet. So here's a plot arc. Those of you who love literature love this witch hat. So a plot arc is basically just the basic elements of a story that all stories have. So all stories have a setting. All interesting stories, I should say. All stories have a conflict. The conflict is the thing that creates tension in the story, that grows over the course of the story. There might be multiple problems in a text, but the conflict is the one that's creating the tension that's going to last through the whole story. And then there's a climax. The climax is when we are on the edge of our seat and we are just biting our fingernails because the tension has grown so high and we don't know what's going to happen. And then the second that tension starts to go down, we've moved into resolution. And finally, we have a new setting. Now, plot arc can be really hard to grasp. So I'm going to real quick illustrate it for you from the defining movie of my daughter's generation, Frozen. So, Frozen, setting, two sisters, one has magic, one doesn't, all is fun and games until conflict. Elsa injures Anna with her magic. Suddenly, Elsa's afraid of her magic, she's distancing herself from her sister, and they're running in different directions, they're not working together, there's all these other characters involved, but the tension keeps growing around this divide between the sisters, until we get to a climax. Both sisters are about to die, and they are running away from one another. And so, you've heard, I've identified that the conflict is the divide between the sisters. So, in my version of the Frozen plot arc, it resolves the second Anna turns and starts running towards Elsa to save her life. If you've seen the movie, you know what I'm talking about. From that moment, you know everything's going to be okay because the sisters are coming together again. Elsa magically suddenly can control her magic, and, you know, we've got personal flurries and everything's all happy at the end in our new setting. So that's plot arc in a nutshell, and every story has one, including 1 Kings 18, 20 to 40. Now, every story has one, but let me say, this is a strategy that is more helpful in some texts than in others. And I'm picking this because I think it's a helpful one here, and we're going to practice with it. So I want you guys to read this text out loud, and then you're going to identify the sections of the plot arc with verse numbers, okay? And maybe this is more helpful. Is it more helpful to leave it up like this? Okay. I'll leave it up like this. So I'm going to give you guys 4 minutes on this because this takes some time to really wrestle with it. And you might find it helpful to start by identifying the conflict. Okay? Go. All right. So let's bring it back together. If you didn't get to all the pieces, that's okay. Someone else might have filled in a different one, and we'll work together here. All right, so let's start with conflict. What did you guys identify in words, not verses at first? What was the conflict in this passage?
Your God, my God.
Okay, what do you mean? Okay, choose this one or this one. Who has to choose? Yeah, we've got, like, indecisive people, right, who don't know which God they want to choose. People undecided. And where did that get introduced? What's the first verse where that gets introduced? 21. All right, we're not going to fill in the end of that yet. But what that means is that where's our setting? 20. We have a very short setting here, and that's okay. All right, so if the people are undecided and we have tension building throughout, what did you guys come to as the resolution, the moment where the tension starts to break? Okay, I'm hearing numbers. Someone say words. Fire. Good. Yes. Fire. When the fire falls. And now give me a verse. Yes. So give me verses. We don't have to just.
38 and 39.
Yes. I wrote it down. That means it's permanent. It cannot be changed. No. I'm writing down what I'm hearing from you guys. But okay. So let's talk climax for a minute. Where did you guys think we're going to come back to this idea? Thank you. I'm glad we have differences of opinion, actually. Okay. Okay. Why do you think Elijah's prayer is the climax? Why is that the moment of highest tension? Yeah. Is God going to show up? Baal didn't show up. So, yeah, what are the verses of his prayer? Thank you. Okay. Now, I hear where you guys are going, because I told you that the conflict and the resolution need to be related, right? You're not to resolution until the conflict starts getting solved. So I think you guys could absolutely make a case that the fire belongs up here in the climax because we don't know how the people are going to respond yet. So you can make that case, and I could be convinced by you. Absolutely. So what does that leave us for a new setting? Yeah, 40. So if this is our structure, and let's go with it this way for now and eliminate the question about where the fire belongs. Let's just go with this. Oh, I forgot to fill this in. That means our tension is building all the way through verse 30, or our conflict is developing all the way through verse 35. Okay, so if this is our structure, then the next thing we need to think about is what's the emphasis that's being revealed by this structure? What's being emphasized in this text? So often with plot arcs, the emphasis will fall around the climax or the resolution. Often, not always. So go back to your tables for a minute and talk about what you think the emphasis is in this text. Go. Yeah, the Lord is the God in Israel alone, right? That's the emphasis of this text. Wow. So that really clarifies my initial bad reading about characters, doesn't it? Let's think about our use of it on evangelism again. Elijah is bold in this text, is he not? So we're not going to like flip around and disparage him. But we see that the emphasis is not on his boldness. The emphasis is on the Lord. And this could absolutely be a great text for encouraging people to evangelize. But it's not because be bold in your evangelism like Elijah. It's be bold because the Lord is God and he is worth following. So this is a good start. We would go on to further study and refine with context and think about gospel connection and really then bring it home to our people. But I know plot arc is a hard strategy to use.